Well, happy Shabbat to everyone. Welcome to Yada Ya Radio. My pleasure to be with you. It's my pleasure also to welcome, I would assume that is both Larry and JB on the line. Is that so?
That would be right.
Hi, Larry.
Hi.
It is an amazing experience to be able to contrast what we're going to review with what I have been reviewing. For the last week or so, I've been trying to chronicle the history of Rome. Writing a short history of Rome, of course, is not an easy thing to do. But I found myself yesterday writing about the Roman religion. Now, there's a lot of places where the Roman religion enters into the picture when I'm trying to detail the centuries of Roman wars. But in this one particular war, and it was it happened because the Romans and the Carthaginians kept on fighting over Sicily. And there was a Roman blockade of this one town in Sicily that they constantly fought over. And the Carthaginians were able to break the blockade. So the Romans decided that they would go and punish those blockade runners who were trying to feed the people in the city they were trying to starve to death. And the Romans, their custom before any one of their naval battles is they always had a flock of religious chickens on the command ship, a flock of religious chickens. And it was the consul's job. The consul would be the highest ranking elected official in Rome. That would be, you know, the Senate of Rome would elect the consul. And the consul was always commander-in-chief and literally the general of the armed forces. So it was the consul's responsibility before any battle to throw grain before the religious chickens. And if the religious chickens ate the grain, then the Roman gods were going to participate in the battle on behalf of the Romans. If they didn't eat the grain, then the Roman gods were going to take the day off. Now, throwing grain before chicken, you would think that most of the time they would choose to eat the grain. I mean, that's what chickens do. But at this particular battle, the chickens didn't eat the grain, and so all of the Roman troops were just horrified as to how, you know, this was just this foreboding omen. And so the Roman consul threw the chickens in the ocean and said the reason they weren't eating is because they really wanted a drink of water. And they proceeded just to get pummeled in this particular battle, and he lost most of the Roman fleet.
And then, so, they were Greeks at that time, weren't they, in Sicily, I think?
No, well, Sicily had Greek colonies, but Sicily was this mix of, it had Greek colonies along the south. It had a number of Carthaginian colonies. Sardinia also was almost all Carthaginian, because Carthage was in where today's Tunisia is. So directly south of Sicily was where Carthage was. And there was also the Syracuse were in Sicily. In fact, the whole history of Sicily and its mercenaries and the piracy, it's really an interesting story of the history of Sicily. So anyway, the Roman commander, who has lost now the majority of the Roman navy, he's brought back to Rome, and he's tried and convicted of treason. And he was convicted of treason not because he lost a few thousand Roman sailors who were killed in the battle.
Because of what he did with the chickens.
Not because he lost two-thirds of the Roman fleet. It's because of the sacrilege of throwing the Roman chickens into the drink.
Wow.
So,
yeah, that's the kind of people I want to be fighting with. Let me tell
you.
Waste a few thousand guys, and the problem is the chickens. Yeah.
Well, the reason I tell this story is because we had a caller today that, you know, it was Glenn who calls in the Shattering Myths show quite often. And Glenn he's a bright guy. He was not pleased that I was calling socialist secular humanism a religion. And was
that is.
It's the national religion of America, and it has its own moral code, which is called political correctness. And, you know, there's all sorts of aspects of the moral code that are a religious moral code. It was a religion actually created by Adam Weishaupt.
That was the whole point of it. Yeah, it was political correctness and to forget about the Torah.
And to take over academic institutions, to brainwash the public in general to accept their new moral code and their new religion, a religion of enlightened men, over the Roman Catholic religion, which was dominating Europe. That was the whole concept of it. Anyway, so I talk about it as a religion. He was having a fit, and he says, you know, they would still accuse you of having a belief because you've never seen Yahweh. And the reason I shared this story about the running afoul of the religious chickens is to point out that I have seen him. I've seen him. I've met him. I've gotten to know him. I've had conversations with him. And anybody, I'm not special in this regard. I am from his perspective, but not because of me. He is there waiting for anyone to see him just by reading his word. He is literally represented in these words that we're going to read. And I want to say, if you use your eyes and you see him through his words, you are seeing him much more clearly than did Abraham, when Abraham walked with him and talked with him and ate with him. You're seeing him much more clearly than did Adam when he walked in the garden with him. You're seeing him much more clearly than did any one of the disciples. You're seeing him much more clearly even than Moshe did. If you want to see him as clearly as he can be seen and known, just simply observe his testimony. Read it. And he is literally manifest in these words. And that's not an exaggeration, right? God created the language of Hebrew and shared this testimony with us for the express purpose of us getting to meet him and know him. And, you know, when we are in heaven and we are a spiritual being, I expect that the way that we are, that for the most part, you know, day in and day out, for the most part, the way we're going to experience one another and learn one another is via communication. Because when you're energy-based, you don't have a physical form that can be seen. So we're going to be communicating and exploring and getting to know each other through words, through just forms of communication like this. That's how we're going to get to know and enjoy our time with God, is through communication. So, if we compare what religion was like during the time that Yahweh revealed these words to Moshe and through him to us, this is the stark difference between the world of man and the testimony of God. So we are indeed privileged to come into direct contact with the creator of the universe through these words. Any thoughts on that, guys? All right, so let's begin with we're in the Chaff letter. It is drawn in the form of a circle with an X inside. It is used to depict two things. One is the X signifies a signature. Now, this is my mark. This is my signature. You have my word on it. When God wants to emphasize that he has signed something, that this is from him, that you can trust him, that He's given his oath or signature on it. He uses the teth as the means to do that. And the second aspect of it is the circle part of it, with his signature, the X in the middle, and the circle represents being enclosed. In fact, many think that the X and the circle represent a woven basket, and in a woven basket you would harvest your grain and you'd harvest your olives and put them inside, and so it's the enclosure for harvested fruit like barley, grain, and olives. Pardon?
Souls?
souls. So
yeah.
Exactly. That's the very things that represent souls. So we're going to begin with Psalm 119:65. And before I begin with and read this to you, I believe that we turned to the 119th Psalm because someone had written Larry, and I think it was one of the people that has the Hebrew Roots group. And we're trying to tell Larry that our observations in the Torah, and even in Psalm 119, that God wants us to observe what he has written, which is to read it, and he wants us to listen to what he has to say, which is to recite it, is invalid. That what he really wants us is for us to do what he tells us.
Yeah, every other word was obey. And it was actually, he's not a member of Hebrew Roots. It was Roger in Unpopular Truth. It just, he kept, pointing out, do this, do that, obey this.
I'm glad to stand corrected. So it was somebody that is in Unpopular Truth. Mm-hmm. And he wrote you and said, here are examples of where it says in the 119th Psalm to do certain things. And so what I did is I went through the 119th Psalm, because the Hebrew word for to do is ashah. Now, ashah can mean to do, but what I have found is if you translate it as engage in or act upon, in the context that Yahweh uses it, which is typically he will use it in conjunction with one of several things. One is if you'll listen and then act upon what you hear. If you observe and come to understand through observation, and you act upon what you have learned. Or he'll use it in conjunction with his favorite terms, misbot, the means to resolve disputes. He says, so if you come to understand the misbot, the means to resolve disputes, and you engage based upon them, or the terms and conditions of the covenant, and you engage based upon them. So it's act upon and engage are almost always the best way to describe it, to translate it. So what I also, I looked up every use of Ashah in the 119th Psalm. And what I found was that the first use of Ashah in this Psalm devoted to teaching us how to properly observe the Torah, you had to get 65 verses into it before you finally got the use of Ashah. So it was the very fact you have to get 65 verses into it of him telling you how he and we therefore should observe the Torah, and the first time you have a do verb, it's in the 65th verse. That means we're a third of the way through, more than a third of the way through.
Yeah, means that Yahweh running around asking us to do and obey a bunch of commands, it's isn't
nonsense.
There.
You know. It's nonsense. The other thing I found is that the first two times that the verb do, which is act upon or engage in, is used, guess who's doing the doing?
Yahweh is.
There you go. It's Yahweh who is the one who is engaged in acting, not Dode. So
right.
Even when you finally get to the first use of the Hebrew word for do, which is the closest thing that Hebrew has to obey, is act upon and engage in. I mean, that's the closest it gets. And you have to get 65 verses in before you find it. And the first two times it's used, for example, here in the 65th verse, it's Yahweh who's the one that's acting, not Dode. All right, so here we go. You have actively engaged and accomplished. Every time that we have a you in this psalm, it's Yahweh, because Dode is talking directly to him. So you have actually engaged and accomplished good, beneficial, and generous things with your servant and co-worker, Yahweh, in accordance with your word. So it's God is the one that's doing, but it's interesting, God is doing it with Dode. This points out a lot of interesting things. You know, if you want to be engaged in Yahweh's work, then the way to accomplish that, the way to position yourself in a place where you can be engaged with Yahweh, doing the things that are important to Yahweh, is to spend the first 64 statements that you utter focused on observing the Torah, listening to the Torah, reading the Torah, and focusing on the four most important aspects of the Torah.
And understanding the Torah.
Oh, yeah, and acting upon the Torah, and celebrating the Torah, and putting the Torah in your mouth, and sharing the Torah, and when somebody complains against you, recite the Torah. I mean, it's just, that's the answer to the question, how you position yourself like that. But the second thing is, if you want to be engaged doing what's important to God, it's really a good idea to first learn what's important to God. You know, that's why these people that pray, oh, God, you know, tell me your will for your life, you know, I want to do your will. But they never bother to read his Torah.
Yeah, right. That's his will, that you read his Torah. That's what he says over and over and over again, you know, but okay. Yeah.
And if you read his Torah, you'll find out what is God interested in. He's interested in the covenant. And so if you share the covenant with other people, you're doing God's will. If you participate in the Torah and the covenant, you're doing God's will. If you keep the Shabbat, as we are, set apart as a special day for reading and reciting his testimony, you're doing his will. And so Dode is saying, hey, God, you acted, you engaged in really good, beneficial, and generous things with me. You know what one of those things were, first and foremost? He shared his Torah with Dode, and Dode took advantage of it and was enlightened and enriched through the Torah. That's one of the things that Yahweh did that was good and beneficial with Dode. I find that when I'm studying Yah's testimony is when I am most enriched by my relationship with God. That's when he does his most empowering and beneficial work with me. You know, other people may have a different experience, but I find that if I'm doing the same thing that Dode was doing here and listening to God and reading his testimony, that's when God does his most beneficial and generous things with me. Now, the thing here that is the guarantee that we're interpreting this correctly is the way that he ends it. You have actually engaged and accomplished good, beneficial, and generous things with your associate, your co-worker, Yahweh, in accordance with your word. So it gets right back to the stupidity of the Christian prayer, God, tell me your will for my life. You want to know God's will? Read his word. You want to be doing what God wants you to do? Make certain that your life is in accord with, consistent with, Yahweh's testimony.
It was something that always amazed me when I would ask somebody something and they'd say, well, I'm going to go pray about that.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Oh,
I mean, here's
Greek
his words. Here's his words right here. This is what they say. And you're going to go pray about them to see if what he meant, what he said?
And by the way,
you know, when I'm sharing words, I hear things like that. I really do. You know, I'm amazed by it.
Now, let me just question you on this. When a Christian goes to pray, when a religious person goes to pray, what happens?
That's an abomination.
It's not acted.
It's not heard by Yahweh.
They begin to yabber. If you're asked, and I've been asked, you know, during my youth, I was asked a gazillion times, could you come and lead us in prayer?
Yeah, I did that too.
Never once did I go up there and just be quiet and listen. Never once. When a Christian prayer is something a parent wants to pray a Christian prayer before bedtime with their children, they begin by yabbering. A Christian prayer isn't about listening to God. It's about telling God what they want.
Yeah, Santa
Claus. How are you going to learn God's will when you're telling him your will?
One of the things I noticed is at the end of it all, they would say, "But your will be done." That way, if they didn't get what they wanted, you know, it was still okay. Like,
yeah.
I saw them pray for a lot of people dying. They all died, by the way.
Yeah, of course.
Know? And I never understood that. It was almost like a regular thing, you know. And you'd be like, "Why are you?" I would be thinking, you know, to me, it didn't set well because I thought, okay, they're praying for somebody they're gonna be having a funeral here in a couple of days or weeks.
Yeah,
that's the end of it. Why are they doing it? You know.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. It's a very odd circumstance that that Christians put themselves in, where rather than putting themselves in the center of God's will by reading His words and experiencing God engaging and doing beneficial things with us when we're listening to what He has to say, they instead think that the way that you develop a relationship with God is you tell Him what you want. It gets right back down to the fact that God is not interested in saving everyone.
Well,
that
there's no prayer in the Torah. There's a lot of listening to, and there's speaking to, with, talking with, even walking with Yahweh. But there's no prayer in the Torah.
No.
Not as we were taught it.
The Hebrew word for prayer appears 4 or 5 times in the entirety of the Torah. And every time it appears, it's never once in God's voice. It's never an instruction from God. It's never a part of God's guidance. There are three or four times where an individual is shown praying. But God never responds to them. God never encourages them to do it. God never says, "That's a really good idea."
Yeah.
And so there is, you can say that there is, emphatically, there is no, in a book called Instructions, there's not a single instruction on praying.
No.
No guidance regarding praying. And there's a reason for that. God's whole approach is, listen to what I have to say, read
and act upon it.
Yeah, read what I have written. And then if we respond to it, that's why I like to translate asa as act upon or engage in. Because if you were to completely, and this was just such a radical shift for me, there's two huge radical shifts from my life as a Christian to my life in the covenant. And one of those is that as a Christian, of course, I was praying to God. And
that's
in the
right.
covenant,
yeah, praying to God.
Which means talking to God.
Yeah, you were trying to direct him. Yeah, sure.
Right, trying to direct him. This is what I want, God. And as a participant in the covenant, I'm listening to God.
Yeah, giant difference. Giant difference. One is a religious activity, by the way, and one is not.
Right.
And all Yah was doing, you know, what it appears to me, is that he's sharing these words, and he wants us to share these words so that people can take the opportunity to jump on board in the covenant.
Right.
And that's it. There's no more to it than that. And it's for relationship, and he hates religion.
Right.
So, you know, the exclusion of religion in so many ways, I mean, in every way, is a great thing. And I don't understand praying for people that are sick. I don't understand it. I don't do it.
I don't do it either. I don't get it.
It doesn't make sense to me.
Now, I don't have a problem with those. In fact, we have a really good friend in the covenant that enjoys the time that he spends talking to Yahweh, his dad. Now, I have diminished the amount of talking I do to Yahweh. I spend a lot of time listening to him and responding to him, but my response is mostly, wow, that was interesting. Can you help me understand this? I'm stuck on this. I'm not sure I get this. My communication will be all just in my mind. I'll say, okay, I hear what you're saying here, but I'm not processing it. You know, and I need help with this. And then I'll receive some enlightenment on it and say, oh, wow, that's really good. I like that. That's clever. Good one.
Yeah, which is exactly what Yahweh says happens, that the Ruach feeds the Nesama while a person is studying his word. Yeah,
exactly.
That's what it says.
And there are times that I will say, you'll say, hey, you know, I'm going to go do X, Y, Z, and, you know, I'm just not up to this. I'm sure you recognize I need some help here. And there's lots of times where I'll just express appreciation, you know, like Dode is doing here, and I will express appreciation. But for the most part, the difference between being a Christian and being in the covenant now is I've tried to become a better listener. Now, you wouldn't know it because, of course, you do these shows, and during the shows don't work really well if I just sit here and listen. in fact, I think it's 5 seconds of silence and alarms go off on the at GCN on the Shattering Myths shows. So if I have a pregnant pause, if it lasts for 5 seconds, it sends off alarms that you have to write a whole report on as to why you had the moment of silence. So, you know, so I talk a lot. But that's not – and I enjoy the talking with family, but Yahweh was really interested in us being good listeners. The other thing that is so different, as a Christian, I was always fixated on my salvation and the salvation of others. Do you know you're saved? And then trying to help other people with their salvation. And as a member of the covenant, my interest in salvation has diminished about 99.999%. I mean, it's almost to the point that I don't even like talking about it, because it's so insignificant to me. Now, today I was presenting, again, Paul's two statements in the Galatians where he says the Torah cannot save, and then he says in the second one, in the Torah, that it's only through faith that someone lives, that it's not through the Torah that there is life. And then it struck me, as I'm reading this, Paul's assault against the Torah isn't on the Torah's capacity to enable us to engage in a relationship with Yahweh. His assault on the Torah is that the Torah can't save you. But the purpose of the Torah is not to save. The purpose of the Torah is to introduce us to Yahweh. So we come to know who he is, and then we understand what this covenant is and what what is expected of us and what is being offered to us. And while salvation is certainly part of the discussion of salvation is only in context of the covenant's children. And so he established, Paul established this whole improper focus on salvation and eternal life without even addressing the prerequisite. And in fact, there's more than just one prerequisite. The covenant, participating in the covenant, is the ultimate prerequisite. But there is actually a prerequisite before one participates in the covenant.
Well, they have
Anybody
to,
want to take a stab
walk out of Babylon. Religion. I mean,
yeah, you know, walking out of Babylon is. But I'm even talking about that. Yes, it's true that that to participate in the covenant, the initial requirement or prerequisite of the covenant is to walk away from Babylon. That's the first of the five. I think
he's male. He has to be circumcised. I guess.
Yeah. Well, that's the fifth of the five.
Yeah.
I think there's something that has to take place even before you walk away from religion and politics.
Yeah, well, to do that, you'd have to be listening to Yahweh. Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, I mean, my point is
you have to
the
want
first thing
to
you
know
have to
him.
Do, you have to come to know him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is no way in the world you're going to walk away from religion and politics unless there is this sense that there is a God who is knowable and that what you have come to know about him, at least up to this point, because we don't start in our relationship in having a complete understanding of Yahweh. But you've got to at least be at the point of saying, there is this God, and I'm starting to get to know him, and what I'm coming to know, I like. And so he is offering a relationship, and there's these conditions to participate in these relationships. I'm going to do this. But you only would do it is if you first come to know, A, that God exists, B, who he is, and C, that you come to actually like who you're getting to know. I think those things are actually a prerequisite before the prerequisite.
Maybe.
What do you think, baby?
I mean, it says form a relationship. The people who form a relationship and love Yahweh's name, as an example, in Yasha Yu. So, yeah, there's a relational thing going on. There has to be.
Yeah.
He says
that. When Yahweh introduced himself to Abraham, he started by introducing himself. Now, the first thing wasn't leave Babylon. The first thing was, you know, here I am. You know,
I'm Yahweh.
Yeah, I'm Yahweh. Yeah, Yahweh met Moshe. The first thing wasn't, okay, let's go. You, follow me. Let's start. Here's an introduction. Here's who I am. First of all, I want to establish the fact that I exist as God. Then I'm going to introduce myself by name. And so that's how it began. So I do think that is is part of it. And I think that, of course, Christians are shortchanged in both of these respects, all three of these respects we're talking about. One is they never come to know Yahweh. Yahweh is that mean God of the Old Testament that they want nothing to do with, so they never come to know him. Number two, they have no concept of what the covenant relationship with is. In fact, this covenant that we're talking about, they think has been replaced. It's old and there's a new one.
Yeah, because Marcion said so and Paul said so. Yeah,
yeah,
sure.
Paul said so. Yeah. You know, mm-hmm. I at one time used to blame Marcion for the old and new covenant. And it's true that that's what he emphasized, but the introduction of an Old Testament is in the first sentence that Paul wrote. The very first mm-hmm. sentence in the first letter that Paul wrote presents the idea of an old arcane testament, which he calls pornography.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's we can lay the concept of an old, arcane, outdated testament right at Paul's feet.
Yeah, I throw Marcion in because he codified it in a book. You know,
yes.
And threw it out there to the world and literally used the term New Testament and started calling Yahweh's words out of vogue. You know, I mean,
yeah.
That's an insane. How can a man you know, come up with such nonsense? And how can people, I can see how a man can come up with it, but I just don't see how people can buy it. And once they know that's what happened, why stick with
why?
It?
It's, why stick with it?
Yeah.
So anyway, this is a profound statement. You have engaged in and accomplished good, beneficial, and generous things with your associate, your coworker, Yahweh, in association with your word. So by the more time that Dode spent listening to Yahweh's testimony and responding to Yahweh's testimony, the more remarkable things occurred. The positive benefits of, so he's now, Dode is going to itemize some of the things that Yahweh has done that have been to Dode's benefit, in accordance with the word. The positive benefits of judgment, discretion, and discernment, ta'am, the process of being informed, of thinking rationally, of logical decision-making, and then also of understanding based on knowledge, da'at. Teach me so that I might benefit by choosing to respond appropriately, lamad. So indeed, in the conditions of your binding relationship agreement, I completely trust and rely. So the first things first, what is the single most important thing that Yahweh did that was to Dode's benefit? It's the last thing he mentions here. And we're going to get to how he did this in a bit, and the first sentence, part of this sentence. But the last part of it, Dode is announcing the most important thing that Yahweh did that was beneficial for Dode.
What, that he came to trust and rely on Yahweh?
Yeah, so it says, so indeed, in the terms and conditions of your binding relationship agreement, your mitzvah, I completely trust and totally rely. Dode came to realize that Yahweh's work through any one of his children is itemized, is quantified, is described by the mitzvah, the terms and conditions of the covenant, of which there are 10. Because now he's dealing not only with our 5 points of participation, but also with his
also
5 benefits. So
yeah.
You want to know how Yahweh works through us and does good through us? It's the benefits of the covenant. It's also the conditions of the covenant, which are also beneficial, but makes us immortal, makes us perfect, adopts us as his children, enriches us and empowers us. That's how God worked in accordance with his word to the benefit of Dode. So he then says, now how did Dode then get to that position where Yahweh could benefit him? He is asking God, responding to God in the way that we all are talking about. The positive benefits, the tub, the good and favorable attributes, the constructive and affirming attitude associated with judgment, discretion, and discernment, the process.
Yeah, associated with what they tell you in Christianity not to do.
Right.
Don't judge anything. Don't exercise judgment. How stupid.
Yeah, so what Dode is saying here is that the exercise of good judgment, being discerning and discriminating, but based upon understanding that comes through knowledge, that's what enabled him to be able to respond appropriately. So this is the antithesis of faith. Faith is the belief in that which cannot be known and understood. And Dode is saying here the positive benefit of being judgmental, of being discerning, of being discriminating, when coupled with understanding that is based upon knowledge, is the way that Yahweh teaches us so that we can respond appropriately to him, and especially to the terms and conditions of his covenant. And when we go through this process of understanding through examining the evidence, by exercising good judgment and discretion and discernment, and then we respond to the terms and conditions of Yahweh's covenant because we've come to know them, we've come to understand them, we've come to evaluate them, we've come to desire them, then we are in a position to respond by choosing to totally trust and rely upon what Yahweh is offering. This is the path to coming to know Yahweh, coming to engage in a relationship with him, and benefiting from that relationship. One of the benefits happens to be eternal life. A pretty good benefit. One of the benefits happens to be perfection, being vindicated. A pretty good benefit. One of the benefits happens to be adoption into his family. Happens to be my favorite benefit. Because once you've got that one, then you can just rest and relax and know dad's going to take care of you. Even when you get a little out of control, a little out of hand, you know, dad's going to take care of you. And then, of course, there's the enrichment part of it, which is this whole process of understanding based upon the acquisition of knowledge and teaching that benefits us. That's the enriching part of it. And then there's the empowerment part of it, which, you know, is also a pretty cool, deal. I mean, that's a really nice benefit to be transformed from matter into energy. But this is the process. It isn't through faith. It's through understanding.
Well, for one thing, when people say faith, they're also saying, you ever notice they coupled that with their own personal purity, if you will. And that doesn't exist in people.
No.
That's a lie. That's called being delusional.
Yeah, you know? They'll even talk about their faith being strong.
Right, but it's not like we run around. You know, I'm not, you know, an advocate of running around as a drunken maniac and serial killer and so forth. You know, hopefully we're kind and we treat people the way we'd want to be treated and so forth. I get that. And that's how I think the world should work. But, you know, at least that's the way my world works. But I will say this, that people that have a tendency to lean to the religious side, or that are religious, I mean, I guess there's no tendency, you're religious or you're not, they seem to want to come across as, hi, I perfectly love you. Hi, I'm a forgiving
and that's
individual.
So phony.
It's delusional. It's delusional.
And it's trying too hard. I would say that the difference between where I was and where I am is very similar to you, Larry, where as an evangelical Christian and an ordained elder in the Presbyterian Church, I felt compelled to set an example, to try to be super knowledgeable, to try to do the right thing, to devote the time to the church. And it was all of these burdens that I felt compelled to do.
Yeah.
And now I don't feel compelled to do anything, to tell you the truth. I don't feel compelled to do anything. I am very comfortable just relaxing and being Yah's dad. If the Shattering Myth show were to end tomorrow, it really wouldn't affect me one iota. I don't feel compelled to do any of it. If you enjoy sharing because you want to share, because you're in this wonderful family, by golly, do it. But don't feel like you have to. I don't think my relationship with Yahweh is significantly affected because yesterday I did something good or today I did something that wasn't so good. I'm really just very comfortable being in dad's family.
Like being real.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, it's...
You know, there was a line that in Josie Wales, or I think it was, he said, it was a Clint Eastwood film, a man's got to know his limitations. I always liked that.
Mm-hmm.
Because the truth of the matter is, religious individuals seem to have no limitations. You know, it's a horrible game they play upon themselves. And the truth is, we all have limitations. You just got to know them and be comfortable with what you've got to work with.
Yeah, and I recognize all my limitations, and I think our inadequacy is what makes us useful in Yahweh's family. When you know that you are incapable without Him choosing to work through you because you're doing things that are of interest to Him, it's that recognizing I can't do this, I'm not qualified, that actually endears you to Him. But I look at it a little different than just my limitations. I look at my limitations only in the sense of, you know, so long as I stay dependent and I don't become self-reliant, then there's a good chance that Yahweh will continue to work through me.
Yeah, by the way, you just nailed the definition of humble. Humble isn't a guy running around, looking down at the ground, scared, it's being reliant. You can't rely on yourself.
Right.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, the other part of this, though, that has just been hugely comfortable for me is that I stopped worrying about what I'm accomplishing. You know, I just, if I'm engaged in, like, I'm writing a letter to somebody and I'm trying to say, you know, what you're telling me about your feelings about being able, like, for example, to cast out demons in Jesus' name, and that you were certain you were saved back in the time you were praying to Jesus, and I will write to you and say, listen, I know what you're telling me, but what you're telling me is inconsistent with what Yahweh has revealed. And so in this dispute between what you feel and what He says, call me crazy, but I'm going to side with what He says. And then the person, you know, might, it typically will blow up and start being really belligerent towards me. And I feel very
comfortable. Yeah, it's an emotional response.
Right, and I feel very comfortable at that point clicking delete.
Yeah.
I don't feel any responsibility for trying to save the person. I'll communicate with them, but they want to respond back. It's not my problem. I mean, I just have released the responsibility. So I look at everything that we do with Yahweh as opportunity, and for a guy that's, you know, been burdened with responsibility all of my life, you know, when you're an entrepreneur and you're making payroll and you've got a bunch of employees and it's your neck and reputation on the line, you've got a lot of responsibility. In this relationship, I look at it as I don't have any responsibility. It's all opportunity, and it ought to be all fun. And the moment it's not fun, and the moment it becomes a burden, and the moment you feel like you have to accomplish something, then I think you're in the wrong place, wrong approach. And one of the reasons I got to that position, and I think that Dode is in exactly the same spot, is that I came to realize that when Yahweh was speaking to the children of Israel, now, Yahweh directly, He is this massive fire on the top of the mountain. I am quite certain that His diction is perfect. I am quite certain that He knows infinitely more than I will ever know in my entire existence. And He is actually the author of this particular plan. And He is sitting here telling in His own voice the children of Israel, who He just has miraculously saved from being slaves in Egypt, this is who I am, this is my plan, this is what I'm offering you. And you know, a bunch of them, most of them, rejected Him. And so...
Yeah, that's amazing.
Okay, yeah. The reason I share the story is that if Yahweh in His own voice, with perfect knowledge and perfect diction and perfect eloquation of rhetoric and knowledge and presentation, can present who He is and what He's offering, And the majority of people who are listening to him will reject it. Why would I ever be bothered?
I'd rather be a slave in Egypt. Well, they must have been stupid. Whatever.
But doesn't it just take all the pressure off? So if I have somebody that is sliming me on an email, and I get a lot of them these days, you know, I'm getting a lot more critical email than I used to get. I get a lot of people not really happy with me, and so I just realized that okay, you know, I'm this dented, dirty, flawed implement, and I'm trying my to share what I've come to know with you. I'm having a good time doing it, and I really ought not expect that the majority of people listening are going to agree. If God's track record was probably sub 5%, and Yosha, you look at Yosha, what was his track record?
Yeah, pretty. What you're talking about in terms of popularity, it was abysmal.
Yeah. Yeah, of the people that he communicated with, the vast preponderance of them rejected him.
Well, they would like the miracles, and then after that, they would kind of fade away, you know.
So most of them didn't even like the miracles. Most of them, when they saw the miracles, were threatened by them.
Yeah, well, they didn't even see the plan. I mean, they didn't get the whole thing. They just didn't get it.
You notice, by the way, that Yosha didn't do a lot of miracles that we are privy to. He's not trying to impress us with miracles. And as a matter of fact, the initial miracles are nurturing us. Something to eat, something for us to consume. And, you know, while he has physically used the miracle of, I've multiplied the number of fishes in the basket to feed the folks and the loaves of bread to feed the folks, again, nothing about this has nothing to do. He did not tell the story to say, yeah, look how powerful I am. I multiplied the number of fishes and the number of loaves of bread. What he's doing is, I just gave you, on this Sermon on the Mount, this Instruction on the Mount, I just gave you the most nurturing words that could possibly be spoken.
Yeah, and it's going to multiply
exactly.
My family. Yeah.
Exactly.
I get it. It's the bread of life, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, we, in a relationship, our attitude is an extremely important aspect of a relationship. And so what we're seeing here in Dode's words is his whole approach to Yahweh. And he came to this attitude, to hold this attitude, by being judgmental. Long before there was this thing called political correctness, he says, my approach is going to be the opposite. I'm going to be judgmental. I'm going to be discerning. I'm going to be discriminating. And he even talked to God about the positive benefits of being discriminating, of being judgmental. Because if you're judgmental, then you can do what he said here, da'ath, go from knowledge to understanding. And then if you go from knowledge to understanding based upon what Yahweh is teaching, then you're in a position where you can respond appropriately.
No, well, you know that.
He's responding to the terms and conditions of the covenant.
I had a girl this week, you know, I was sharing words with and notes with and so forth, and a message. And she said, well, have you seen Rabbi blah, blah, blah? And I said, let me ask you something. I said, that, you know, Yosha said to call no man Rabbi. There's only one teacher, and that's Yahweh. And I said,
yeah.
No.
But he didn't, by the way, he did not use teacher there. Because what he used, he actually used rabbi. And,
what he said is
there is but, because the definition of rabbi is not teacher.
No, I know.
The definition, the rab.
It's exalted is, one.
Exactly. Well, rab means to expand, to be made great. Yahweh uses the basis of rabbi, rab. There is no rabbi, but he uses rab throughout the Torah in conjunction with the inheritance of the covenant. And that is that when we inherit the benefits of the covenant, Yahweh makes his children
expanded.
Rob.
He's expanded.
Okay? He makes us greater than we would otherwise be. We inherit his greatness when we participate in the covenant. So the rabbis chose the title great to describe themselves.
Yeah.
And Yahweh says, don't take the title rabbi great, because there's only one who is great. That's really
yeah.
what he was saying. Yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah, and I asked her, I said, does he wear a hat? She, oh, yeah, he's got, I said, well, I'm done. I'm not listening
Yarmulke.
To a guy like
yeah.
that.
Yeah, and what shape is that hat?
The sun.
Yeah,
that's where that came from. Didn't you? I thought you told me years ago they shaved their head in the shape of the sun and that covered it in Babylon.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that where the yarmulke comes from?
Yeah, yeah. Well, actually, the yarmulke came from the Greeks. When Ptolemy was in charge of that region of Alexander's conquests, during the Maccabean period, there was this a rivalry between Israelites that loved the Enlightenment and the rhetoric and the philosophy of the Greeks and became very Greek. And then there was a group that was very much into the oral law and to religious edicts and the Maccabeans. And so you had these two vying for who was going to control Judaism, if you will. And they both influenced each other, but they ended up coming with an amalgamation that had a little bit of both. But the yarmulke that is worn
came
is
from the Greek side of it.
Is from the Greek side of it.
Hmm.
Yep.
And wasn't that, didn't that cover their head, shaped in the shape of a
yeah,
sun?
Yeah, oh yeah, they would do that too. But I just think all that stuff, the history of it, I mean, that's a minuscule little thing, but it's the history of it is sort of interesting.
Yeah, except we know that Yahweh didn't have a dog in that fight because he wasn't interested in Judaism any more than he is Christianity or anything else, you know,
right,
other than to expose it.
That's the reason why the Book of Maccabees isn't in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. The Book of Maccabees, which is where Hanukkah comes from, the Book of Maccabees is around 200 to 300 BCE. It's long after the last of the prophetic books had been revealed. And now it's during the time that the Greeks, through Alexander, had come to influence that area. And as you said, Yahweh did not have a dog in that fight. So,
yeah, the last prophetic book would have been Malachi, wouldn't it?
I would think that Malachi, you know, you got Zechariah and Malachi are really pretty similar in terms of time. You know, the biggest prophetic books, like Yeshayah, is around 750 BCE, and then you end up right around Daniel, for example, what I'm doing right now. Daniel was 555 BCE. So,
Zechariah was
Daniel,
right after that.
Right, you get Zechariah and Malachi, and what you find too is that while Yeshayah gives you the entire swath of human history is in Yeshayah, and you know both advents of the Messiah, and some insights as to what the end times are going to be, particularly early on in the book. When you're dealing with Zechariah and Malachi, you're dealing almost exclusively with what's going to happen in the last days. So the last of the prophets were fixated on the last days. Okay, moving to 119:67. Before and prior to that time, I responded and answered this invitation. I unintentionally erred and inadvertently wandered aimlessly. So here Dode is telling us that the way that Yahweh has benefited Dodd and works with him is through teaching Dodd so that Dodd can understand by exercising good judgment what's in Yahweh's testimony, particularly as it pertains to the terms and conditions of the covenant. And then he's saying that prior to the time that he responded to the invitation, because the covenant is an invitation, that he unintentionally erred and inadvertently wandered aimlessly.
A religious path like that.
Yeah, it could be. Could be a political path.
Well, yeah,
path.
That's aimless wandering. You're not doing anything. You know?
Yeah, it could be that, you know, he was agnostic. Could be that he was just, you know, there are some things when we are young that garner more of our attention than does God. You know, if you're a boy, they call them girls. And, you know, there's times in your life when...
That's a good point. Yeah.
We're playing sports. And, I've listened to a lot of girls talk about boys, so we're not alone as guys being fixated with girls at a certain time of our lives. And, you know, it's also true with girls being fixated on guys. Girls are fixated on their relationships, and guys were fixated on their sports. And, you know, Dodd just could have been distracted early on. And that's what he's saying.
You think that's what he's saying there? Yeah, it could be.
Could be.
Know.
Yeah, I unintentionally erred. That could be that he went along with some, the guys and kind of bought into societal customs, that he kind of went along with everybody else.
I think it's something he's talking about as a social norm, which would have, you know, let's face it, the Jews were pretty religious. They were.
Yeah. But he's saying here, too, that, before the time that I responded and answered the invitation, this is an example of, you know, how to respond to the Torah, anah. And, you know, anah is the word that in the rabbinical translations of the Torah is translated afflict. Because, you know, for Yom Kippurim, rather than responding to the invitation and coming into the presence of the maternal aspect of Yahweh's light, they have it, anah, that you should afflict yourself.
Now, how in the world would that help you have a better relationship with Yahweh?
In the rabbinical translations, they're not trying to have you. They don't want you to have a relationship with Yahweh.
Okay.
They want Yahweh to be fearsome and scary and unknowable. They don't want you to have a relationship with Yahweh. Afflicting is just fine. But here, how do you translate this? Before and prior to the time that I was afflicted, I unintentionally erred. But now that I'm afflicted, now that I'm debased, being abused by you, now that I'm being abused, you got my attention the moment you started afflicting me. I'm being afflicted, I know that you're going to whip the living tar out of me. So at this point, I'm on the straight and narrow. So I guess you could render anah afflict, but you know you'd really have to push it here. And by the way, the rabbis that have chosen to render it afflict, and all of the Christians that have followed in their footsteps,
right? Well, yeah,
they know that there are countless places. Anah is used a lot in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. And they know that in the overwhelming preponderance of the time that is used, that it cannot mean afflict, that it must mean before I responded and answered the invitation, before I made my response, my declarative statement. They know that what anah means. They're not doing it out of ignorance.
Well, you know, and Yahweh talks about people that purposefully deceive others, and they're going to be sorry they did it, you know.
Yeah, correct. Yeah. But now, I literally keep my eyes totally focused upon, carefully and completely observing your word, your instruction, and your promise. So here, Dode is saying, I answered the invitation. Yahweh taught me. I processed the information that that God said. I was discerning and judgmental regarding it, and the way that I stopped being aimless was that I carefully examined carefully considered your Imrah, your word and your promise. It's the answer for all of us. You know, you want to get to the point where you are no longer being aimless, where every aspect of your life is directed, every aspect of your life is purposeful, where you know that rather than going astray, you're walking directly to God, that your life is ordered, it has purpose, it has perspective. Observe His word. And we talked about the other day, there is only one way that you can apply the verb observe to a written text, to Yahweh's instruction, to His word, to His promises, and to have that verb make sense. And that's to make it read. The only way that you can observe a written text is to read it. You know? What other actions can you take with a written text other than to read it?
You know, people will take, though. They'll take statements that he makes to, you know, somebody in regards to something, you know, thousands of years ago. And he's talking about a particular thing, and they'll go, okay, then that's what I'll put in my life. And I won't shave my beard a certain way, and I won't do this, and I won't do that. And, you know, they're missing the whole point of the thing, you know. They're running around trying, you know, you can't shave yourself or unshave yourself into, you know, Yahweh's covenant. That's not how it works. You know?
No, there is not a single instruction regarding the covenant when Yahweh is discussing it with Abraham where he says shave. There's not a single instruction with Abraham as he's describing the covenant with him and how to participate in it that he says, you better have that daggon tizzit. If you don't have that thing hanging from your middle, you ain't participating in my covenant. Never once.
Right.
You know, it's those aren't the conditions of the covenant. And once you're in the covenant, you're golden. But the way that you walk to Yahweh along the path that He has provided, the way that you respond to Him is to observe His testimony. And the only thing you can do, the only way that observe and written words work together, because that's all Dode's got here. He's got a written copy of the Torah. He's got nothing else. He's got a written scroll of the Torah. The only way he can observe the written scroll is to read it. I mean, it doesn't go any further than that. I know that a lot of people want to change shamar to keep. But how do you keep the Torah? Does that mean that I've got this written scroll of the Torah, I'm going to keep it really close to me? What good is that?
Well, I think they're trying to
keep
say...
keep it beside my bed when I go to sleep at night. What good is
they're
that?
Saying they're keeping the instructions, which they call commands, by the way. They're obeying His commands. That's what they
right.
say. They're obeying His commands. And yet, I just went through it with a new guy and a bunch of new people on his page today. You can't pay a tithe. How are you going to do it? There's no storehouse. It was never paid in money.
Right.
You know.
Correct.
How are you going to do it?
Right.
And
you're going to take
10%
of the wood on your that you harvest from your property, and where are you going to take it?
Yeah, there's no storehouse. That's what I said.
Right.
You know,
right.
And there you said. Now, how are you obeying these commands? And I said, by the way, because she was, you know, using these terrible translations from the Septuagint, command and obey. And I said, you know, whatever happened to free will? You know?
You are free. Free to do as we say.
You're yeah. free to do whatever you want to do.
Yeah, but
you know,
and that
within
the,
your limits. You know.
There's only two verbs that Yahweh constantly repeats in association with his Torah. One is listen, the other is observe. And the only possible way to have the word keep be appropriate as a translation of observe is to keep your eyes focused. And if your eyes are focused, then
you're observing.
You're reading. Yeah, you're reading. Yeah, I mean, it's... Yeah. But that is it. God wants you to read his instructions. Instructions are meant to be read. He wants you to get to know him by reading his invitations. Dode did that. But now I literally keep my eyes totally focused upon your word, your instruction, and your promise, your Imra. And when you're doing that, you're seeing Yahweh. He was seeing Yahweh through these words. He was getting to know him by remaining focused on these words. He was no longer walking aimlessly by examining Yahweh's written testimony. And by the way, all he had was the Torah. He didn't have anything else. There is no place where Yahweh walks into the tent or to the cave and say, "Hey, Dode, yo, I'm Yah." No, everything that happened between Dode and Yahweh was Dode getting to know Yahweh by reading the Torah, thinking about it, acting upon it. That's it.
He was buried in it.
He was buried in it.
I mean,
give him a King James Bible copy of the New Testament so he could get to know Jebus and, you know, through Paul's letters.
No mention of Jebus. No New Testament, no gospel, not a hint of faith. So the fellow that God declares unequivocally is righteous and vindicated, and that he loves, got to see him through his words in his Torah. There is no other encounter between Dode and Yahweh other than Dode coming to know him, see him, engage with him, and love him the same way we are through reading his words. Now, we have an advantage that Dode didn't have, and that is Dode. Dode didn't have this psalm. He wrote it to help us get to the same place that he is. Well, that's another advantage that we have. You know, Dode had to reason all of this through by reading the Torah, coming to understand what was important in the Torah, and then coming to know the author of the Torah and responding to Yahweh once he understood his guidance. And he had to do it with no tools. He didn't have an interlinear. He didn't have concordances or dictionaries. He just had a scroll of the Torah. That's all he had, that in his eyes and his mind. And he figured it out. And we benefit because we have all these tools and because we also have Dode, who tells us how to properly observe the Torah. Prior to the time that I responded and answered this invitation, this powerful statement, before I thoughtfully spoke and composed these songs, because Anah speaks of composing a song, I was preoccupied and I unintentionally erred. I inadvertently wandered aimlessly without deliberation. I sinned, meaning unwittingly, because I was deceived before I placed, you know, before I placed my faith in mistaken opinions. But now, at this point in time, I literally keep my eyes totally focused upon, carefully and completely observing, closely examining, diligently exploring, genuinely evaluating, investing time in and scrutinizing the complete totality of your word, your instructions, and your promise. And that's really what is being communicated here.
Yeah, and that almost makes me again feel like before he had taken place in some, you know, unwittingly deceived by religious instruction because, you know, it was mistaken opinions. But now at this point, he's literally looking himself and, you know, he realizes those things were wrong. You know,
Right. Do
this, do that, don't do this, don't do that. You know, looking at the Torah like law, maybe, things like that.
Dode's only claim here, really. Now, Dode's in a position that he could claim a lot. He is literally king of the hill. He is the king of the hill.
Oh, yeah. He's the man.
He's the man. Okay? And what he's claiming is that Yahweh taught him when he was willing to focus on and read the Torah. And that he's claiming that the good that God did with him and through him was in absolute accordance with his Torah instructions. And so if this guy is going to come to that conclusion and say, you know, what I've got going for me, the good that I've got going for me, is all the good that you've done with me and through me on the basis of teaching me your guidance through your Torah and me coming to understand it and exercising good judgment regarding it and coming to trust and rely upon the terms and conditions of your covenant, if that's what the king of the hill finally said, he's never saying, you know, yeah, well, I'm in great shape with you because I'm king of Jerusalem. I founded this city. No, he says, I'm in great shape with you because I've come to know and accepted the terms and conditions of your covenant. I've answered your invitation. That's why I'm in this position.
But isn't that what our political actors do? You know, one of them will die or whatever, or
one will
be going on to the next stage. And they're great because of all the time
they've
put in.
Right. Or the offices they've held.
Yeah.
And Dode is saying, he never once mentions, I'm great because of the offices I've held, because I founded Jerusalem, because I'm king of the hill.
Because he said, I'm great because I've listened to your words. Yeah, and I've understood them. Yeah.
I've become great because of what you have done through me and with me in accordance with your testimony. We've become great for the same way. In the same way for the same reason. He then says, you are good, generous and pleasing, Yahweh. Gee, that's so different than the Christian perception of the God of the Old Testament. You are good, generous and pleasing, Yahweh, and are doing what is good and beneficial and best by teaching me how to properly respond to your clearly communicated prescriptions of things I should do in life to live, to the choke, to the engraved prescriptions that cut us into the relationship. Dode got to know Yahweh, and the God that he got to know, he thought was Tob. Generous, pleasing, enjoyable, festive, beautiful, pleasant to be around. Tob's just a really cool word. He's not calling God great here. This isn't Yahweh Akbar. He's not calling God great. His approach to God is the same one that we're articulating. Okay, I understand God's great, but that's not what Dode is saying here. What he's saying is, Yahweh, you're generous. You're pleasing. You're enjoyable to be around. You're fun. You know? What a powerful...
It always got me how little he ever said to Abraham and Sarah. I mean, You know, he's just like hanging out with him. He didn't say a lot.
You're pleasant to be around, Yahweh. And Yahweh, you're doing what is beneficial, what is best, when you teach me how to properly respond to your inscriptions, your inscribed prescriptions that cut us into the relationship, your choke. And then, after telling Yahweh, you know, okay, I understand you're God. I understand you created the universe. I understand you authored life. I understand that you're the author of this book that I find so enormously beneficial. And I'm responding to you as just saying, hey, you're a cool dude. You're fun to be around. Then he transitions. He says, the self-important and the self-motivated, the Zed, the arrogant and haughty, the presumptuous and insolent, they lie. They mislead and they deceive with their speeches, smearing and slandering me with misinformation. The comparison between the presumptuous, you know, when Obama tongue lashes China and tongue lashes Russia and tongue lashes Israel and pretends like he is the high and mighty one. You know, he got up the other day and was talking about the worst of human nature still exists, and we are witnessing it in Nigeria with the kidnapping of those little girls, and the worst of human nature. And he's, you know, presenting himself as a paradigm of virtue. And what Dode is saying is, listen, the God that created the universe, he's a cool dude. He's approachable. He's fun to be around. And yet you've got these arrogant humans that are self-important and self-motivated, and they're just absolutely full of themselves. They're lying. They're deceiving in their speeches. And not only do they smear God, they smear those of us who have a relationship with him. You know, and it's in this particular thing, the smearing and slandering me with misinformation, ad hominem attacks. I will, with all of my heart, engage my protector and savior by keeping close and by observing the pakudim, the prescriptions that you have entrusted to us that enable us to respond appropriately to you. I will with all of my heart, which in the Hebrew is that's the sum total of everything that I am. You know, I've looked with my eyes, I've read, I've thought, I've contemplated, I've examined, I've come to know, I understand. But even beyond, when you talk about the heart in Hebrew, it is beyond knowing. It's beyond understanding. It's beyond all of that to the point of, this is so important to me. This is so what I want to have and to be that I'm incorporating what I have seen and learned and come to understand into the totality of who I am. That's when they talk about the heart in Hebrew. That's what he's talking about here. I've gone from knowing and understanding and accepting to fully incorporating. I will with all of my heart engage my Savior by keeping close to and by observing. That's ours, equal parts, saving and observing. Your precepts, your prescriptions that enable us to respond appropriately to you. Calloused and incapable of feeling, indeed unresponsible and gross, are their hearts like fatty oils. And here, what we're seeing is the contrast of Dode saying, you know, I get it. I'm receptive to what you're offering. That makes me, like you, beautiful in your eyes. But those who are flapping their lips and are self-pretentious, he says that they're unresponsive, they're gross, and their hearts are like fatty oil. So if living waters are even offered to a fatty oil, does the oil and water mix?
No.
No. And so he will go on to say, with all of this now, he is talking about observing, teaching, learning, evaluating information by being judgmental and discerning, and thereby responding. And now he says, your Torah is actively engaged in my life because I delight in it, finding something I totally find totally enjoyable. Yes, that's all he had was the Torah. He had nothing more. And he says, of Yahweh's Torah, it's actively engaged in my life because I delight in it. I find it totally enjoyable. Studying the Torah wasn't a burden for him. Studying the Torah was the joy of his life. And it should be for us. I know it is for me. My day, lots of things will happen, and the time I just spend studying the Torah, that's the highlight. Always is. I read some of the comments as I came here to do this program this evening, and almost all the comments were, it's the beginning of the Shabbat. We're going to observe Yahweh's testimony. Best time of the week. That was Doe's impression. I think every member of the covenant family, that's their impression. Yahweh's teaching, his guidance, is what we actively engage in, what we make an integral part of our lives because we delight in it. We find it totally enjoyable.
Yeah, I enjoy the learning, and then I enjoy the sharing what I learned. That's what I enjoy.
That's what I enjoy, too. And, you know, is it possible for you to learn a law?
Learn a law?
Yeah. No, really? It's impossible. Has there ever been a law that was written, you say, wow, I really take delight in that law. That law is totally enjoyable.
No.
I mean, just to think of how twisted you'd have to be to replace Torah here with law. Boy, your law, I want to tell you, I have actively engaged your law in my life because I delight in it. It's something I find totally enjoyable. Yeah, right. Uh-huh.
Law
An enjoyable law.
Law restrictive and limiting. Construction helps you to grow.
Oh, of course, yeah. A law restricts what you
complete
can do.
Complete opposites.
Yeah, law is restricting.
It controls your behavior.
Right. Yeah, a law is restricting and controlling, and teaching is uplifting, enlightening, and liberating.
Empowering.
Those that write laws aren't exactly interested in people becoming empowered.
No. Speaking of the Torah, it's the Torah is good and beneficial for me. Tov law. That indeed you responded, providing your testimony for the purpose of teaching me how to properly respond to your engraved, clearly communicated prescriptions of how we can be cut into the relationship choke. I love your Torah. I delight in your Torah. Your Torah is good and beneficial for me. That indeed you responded, providing your testimony for the purpose of teaching me how to properly respond to you. He is literally defining the purpose of the Torah. And he's explaining why he loves the Torah. It's relevant to his life. It provides enlightenment, freedom, enjoyment, purpose. His absolute favorite thing in the universe, which is how we also view the Torah, which is why we've chosen to be Yahweh's children. Now we've come to the end of our hour and a half, but it's marvelous what we can learn. You know, and I think that today, fellas, that what we found is just that everything that we've come to know and understand is reinforced. It's consistently proclaimed. God's method of teaching us is to tell us what he's going to tell us and tell us what he told us. And each time you go through it, you just find more affirmation that this is right. And certainly we've come to this appreciation that to observe the Torah is to read it, and to properly observe the Torah the way Yahweh wants us to, we have to process the information that's in it and think about it and then respond to it. And that's what he said here. But to go through the song of God's favorite person, who he said, you've achieved the thing that I'm looking for here, which is to be vindicated. And to see him say, this is how I observe the Torah.
Yeah, they did it through understanding. Through understanding. Through reading it and understanding it. And I you can't get this through to so many people. I mean, there was a guy, I tried to beat that into his head for 2 years. And, I kept bringing him back on. Next thing you know, he'd be, but nobody, if they're not wearing the sitzits, aren't allowed to sit at my Pesach table. And I unfronted him for the last time. I said, well, you're not getting this. You're just not going to get it.
Yeah. You know? There's a reason that the vast preponderance of the Torah cannot be done. Because it's not about the doing. It's about the understanding. And the only way that you can come to understand is to recognize the Torah is teaching, and that if you listen to teaching and you process it and you think about it, you will come to understand, and that puts you in a position where you can respond appropriately.
Yeah, and how much once the temple's gone, how much of the Torah could you really do? There's a whole lot right there you couldn't do, right?
I think that the Tizit is an important instruction.
I think it is important too.
There's guidance in it. There's one blue thread.
Yeah, that's the living Torah. That's Yahusha.
Right.
I get it.
Yeah. There's one
except
blue thread.
They're walking
there's...
around with them today, and they're all white or they're all purple, and they're not white with a purple thread going through.
Yeah, it's one white with one blue thread right through it. And the blue thread says, you know, there's one way to enlightenment. There's one God. There's one path. There's one Torah. There's one covenant. And, you know, it doesn't weave all that one line. It doesn't weave. It's not serpentine. Straight. And so there's a lot that you can say. And if you gird yourself with something that says that you get it, that there is one God and one way and one Torah and one covenant and one path
You mean Oprah's wrong that there's not many different paths to God? Oh.
Yeah, she's wrong.
Right now.
She's wrong. Yeah,
wow.
I know. Right
I didn't know
yeah.
that.
You can add that to the list.
Yeah, I can add that to the list of things where she's wrong. But Dode got it. And should we ever doubt for a moment that this is what God intends for us to do with his Torah. All we need to do is continue to turn back to this psalm. The longest psalm, one that takes the 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet, goes through each of the 22 letters in alphabetic order to tell us how to properly observe the Torah. And I want to tell you, folks, you know, guys I don't care how many people tell us that to observe the Torah is to obey what God said and to do what he said.
There's only
one guy that Yahweh declared. He says, this guy is righteous. This guy is vindicated. This is the guy that I love. I'm going to build my millennial kingdom after his kingdom. I even named the guy beloved. And this is how he did it. That's good enough for me.
No, I was talking about Yahusha. You know, there's only one perfect. I mean, and he even. I'm blown away that people think they can obey. How?
And why? And where's free will if you have to obey?
You know, first of all, you could not do Pesach 100% correctly. Matter of fact, you couldn't do matzah 100% correctly.
You can't even choose the time 100% correctly.
You know, you cannot, for one thing, you'd have to have all the leaven out of your land, right?
Right.
You'd have to have it all out of there, all the yeast out of your land.
Right.
Can you do that? I mean, I don't have the ability to tell stores to stop making their bread and all the rest of it.
No, of course not.
And
you know, I can't sprinkle the blood of the lamb on the mercy seat of the Ark of the Covenant.
No, you can't. I mean, that's what I said. You can't do Pesach 100%. You know, obey.
I don't own lambs.
Yeah.
How am I going to take a 3-year-old lamb from my flock?
Right. We've all been pushed into cities, basically.
Right.
I mean,
yeah.
I don't know anyone who owns lamb.
Yeah. But there is no part of the Pesach instructions that I can't learn from.
Yeah, that's right. And that's what it's all about. And
right.
People want to sit around and, oh, they want to obey commands because it's the law. I mean, that's what it all comes down to. Well, then you might as well just call Yahweh Lord. Go ahead.
Yeah, right.
Because that's what you've made him. You know, that's
when
that's
Yahweh said
him.
That I freed you from slavery. How could you be freed from slavery if you were actually required to be obedient to a Lord and his laws?
Yeah, well, you couldn't, and how could Dode talk about the freedom of the Torah if it was a bunch of laws? And
yeah.
You know what he understands is he's free from judgment, you know, and he's free from running around playing Mr. Perfect and pure of heart and all the rest of that nonsense.
What Dode came to understand is how simple it all is and how profound it all is, and the very fact that he called Yahweh Tob and not Rob speaks volumes.
Yeah, it does. And then, by the way, if Yahweh's words, or if Yahweh was the religious deity that they make him out to be with these horrible translations that they lay out there, then he wouldn't even be worth being around. To me, it's like the difference of, have you ever seen anybody that always has inappropriate affect plastered all over their face?
Oh, sure.
They're usually positive motivational speakers or some weird individual.
Right. Trying to convince you that they have an answer.
Yeah, they're happy.
They're really in the happy place.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. They're in the happy place. That's a good way to put it. But
yeah.
It's just plastered on their face. And then you see somebody that's real next to them. And
right.
And it's day and night. I mean, that's the difference between Yahweh and the religious deity that all the religions push. There's a giant difference.
The very description of Yahweh's Tob: pleasant to be around, fun to be around, approachable, agreeable, enjoyable.
Yeah, that's probably with a great sense of humor. Probably.
Yeah. Well, fun. Yeah, he says, you know, Tob means fun. And so I think that when somebody really gets it, then they begin to see Yahweh as fun. When you begin to see Yahweh as approachable, fun, tobe, enjoyable, pleasant, then you're where Dode is. You're where you and I are, all of us, is that you're no longer putting God on the pedestal.
Yeah, and everybody's got their own thing. I mean, I like to crush religion. I really like it. I love doing it. And Yahweh's real good at it. You know, he's got all these little words, man, he threw in there to say, hey, don't do any of this stuff. You were going through some of them today, I believe, on Shattering Heads. Yeah, and I love it when he does that because that crushes them. Now, people that seriously look at his words aren't going to turn around and use words like gospel and sling pagan crosses around and so forth.
And nor are they going to misquote him. They're not going to misquote God. They're not going to take what he said out of context. They're not going to annul what he has offered. You know, once you understand who God is, then to fall in love with him is to do what Dode did, which is to fall in love with his word. And, you know, you share words. I share words. We share Yahweh's words. Why? Because we fall in love with Yahweh's words.
I share the words you've broken down. I mean, I will admit that, but so what? I mean, you're better at it than I am.
You know, but
I know you want me to go do it.
Does it really matter?
Strong points.
Yeah. Does it really matter that I've spent more time translating Yahweh's words, and that you've spent more time sharing Yahweh's words?
I doubt I spent more time sharing Yahweh's words because
still,
everybody I've shared
why,
words.
Why is the least bit inappropriate that we do that? You're reading Yahweh's words amplified, translated as accurately as somebody who spent a lot of who loves Yahweh, loves his word, spend a lot of time at it, and you're reading it and learning from it and get it. The only thing that bothers me, if somebody takes what I have written and then rather than coming to understand it and wielding Yahweh's testimony, because they are wielding Yahweh's words because they've come to understand Yahweh's words and they want to respond with Yahweh's words. I never get upset with that. The only thing I ever get upset with is the person who will go to the religious person and say, you ought to read Craig Wynn's book. You know, and they will say, you know, read his book. Read this book. You know, in this book he says...
I say you ought to look at Yahweh's words.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, if you focus on what Yahweh says, and then you come to understand it, and you respond using his testimony, that's what he wants all of us to do. He doesn't want us to rely on an intermediary. And you're not. You're reading Yahweh's testimony. There's no intermediary there.
No,
you're
there
never,
isn't.
You're never saying, I am quoting what this Yadok guy quotes. You're not.
What is
Yahweh going wrote.
On IntroToGod.org and yada yada? I mean, when I bring it up, I like it's a bicycle spinning. Now, I know that I can go, like, to his teachings like we're doing, and I have part one, two, and three, or whatever,
right.
And I can hit, you know, PDF file, but I can't do that on the front page or on the other pages.
Yeah, no.
Like part one.
Yeah, we're hoping that this weekend, Yoel is had to completely rewrite the sites. He's done most of the work behind the scenes, and of course, just everything was torn apart by the Muslim attacks on Prophet of Doom, since everything
happened,
the same database and the same servers, has ransacked, you know, everything. And the
they
code
must have
that
got
he
angry with you the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, and the code that he
really
wrote, you know, to do all of it is now antiquated code because the technology changes so much. So he's having to write all of the code to generate all of these sites out of a database. And also to run the forum and also to run all of the things like, you know, the comparative Qurans and all of that, and to be more impervious to denial of service attacks. And all to work on a cloud format using, the evolution of the technology. And it's a lot of work, and the guy donates his work. I mean, he's got like five different jobs, including he's a full-time developer for Dell, for Dell Computers.
Yeah, that's what I do. Obviously,
yeah.
That's
so
a
and he's got a family, and he's coach with his kids and their sports, and so you know.
URL used to be on every one of your shows too.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. So I am extraordinarily patient. If it takes 6 months to get all of this working back the way it once did. And it does work again. I'm the happiest guy in the world. You know,
doesn't he have a bunch of adopted kids? Didn't he adopt some
children? He has three children, but they're all his through he
oh,
and his
okay.
wife.
I don't
so.
Know where I got
no.
that. Okay.
No, he's extraordinary. When I first met him, he was an atheist. And then
that's why he could understand where you were coming from.
Oh yeah, he was an atheist.
JB, wasn't that your position too?
JB was an agnostic mostly.
And same thing, you know.
Yeah, well, that was a little different. It's much easier to communicate with an agnostic than it is with an atheist.
Well, that's true. My dad was just a flat out atheist. His ears would close. Period.
Yeah.
End of story. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so people who are agnostics are typically open. Evidence and reason appeals to them. I know it did for JB, and huge difference.
But okay, so Yoel was just a flat-out atheist. Okay,
he was an atheist when we first met, and he transitioned from atheist to agnostic, and then when the company that I he was the first employee that I hired into Value America, and when the company tanked, he and I developed a really close, trusting relationship. We were close.
Hope you guys sold some stock before.
Yeah,
that
the whole time we were really close. He was always my closest friend in the company, and we would then spend. he's a night owl. We would spend 4 and 5 hours from, you know, 8 o'clock to 1 o'clock at night, sometimes from 9 to 2 o'clock in the morning. And we would do it several times a week. And his whole deal was he was just interested in, he was an agnostic because he knew the religious position was stupid. Dad is Jewish, his mom was Catholic. And so he was, they tried to go to have him, you know, get confirmed and go through catechism in the Roman Catholic Church. And he just absolutely ate up the priest. He says, you know, what you're telling me is completely inconsistent and it's impossible. And so when they, you know, they asked him, you know, do you believe? And he says, hell no, I don't. This is stupid. And so,
that didn't work out too well at catechism, did it?
No. The stories are really interesting as to what the priest would say and how Yoel responded to them, and then how the priest responded to that. And this story, I should tell the story one day because it's really an interesting story. And so he rejected religion, and he was one of those that said that was, you know, that he rejected God because he thought that God had created religions.
Yeah,
and
then
so,
he came to find out religions that Yahweh was totally opposed religions the whole time, and then he goes, now I get
right.
it, right?
Yeah, and then as we were talking about how different Yahweh's position is than the religious position, and particularly things like heaven or you either go to heaven or hell, and he realized that was unbelievably stupid. When he found out there were three destinations, I said, well, that makes sense. And then there were little things. When he found out that God had a sense of humor and liked to yank our chain a little bit, you know, the fun sense of you know, like he's going to say, I'm going to, my harvest is going to occur on the day that no one knows, only the Father, and that was the date that the Jews had changed Teruah to be Rosh Hashanah, and it was called the day that no one knows, only the Father, little things like that. When he talks about Apophis and he says it's going to be nudged and it's going to strike and the date that it's going to strike, you know, he says it's exactly halfway through the tribulation, which is Friday the 13th in 2029, and he's talking about Apophis and it being nudged and it's striking, and then you find that in 2004, MN 2004, the asteroid is named Apophis. And it's going to come within the asteroid, the satellite ring of the Earth, and you go, okay.
Now what month is that? April?
April 13th, 2029. It's exactly the halfway point of the tribulation.
Yeah,
that's
why I say that I think that the way you're viewing the calendar, you know, from 33 CE, some people do 31, as you know.
Yeah,
I think that that's correct for that very reason. I mean, that just pinpoints it almost.
Oh, yeah, everything just falls into place. It's perfectly aligned. Even 968 BCE is the time that everyone knows that the temple was built. And 33 CE is the only year within 7 years either way of Pesach. Beginning on a Thursday evening and going through Friday. And when you look at Daniel's prophecy and you start from the 20th year of the decree, which you learned is in 444 BCE, and you do the math that he's given us, you come to 4 days before Passover in 33 CE.
Yeah, and I am pretty good at math, and I've still never gotten that, and I've read it 3 times. There's something I'm blowing there.
Okay, maybe I need to do a better job of.
Well, no, I mean you throw it out there pretty quick and easy, and then you know, I get into it and look at it and screw it up. So,
one of the challenges is of course that Daniel is using a prophetic year, which is 360 days, and then you've got to multiply the 360 days, but then for the time that he's given. And then what you need to do is then, okay, you look from Passover in 444 BCE, what is that many days to Passover in 444 BCE? So you need to take the number of days that you multiply. You have to divide them by the 365 and a quarter day solar year because, you know, the only way you can get from 444 BCE to the time is to add years. And when you do that, that's how it comes out. So the math is not all that easy. It does take some work because you've got to multiply it by the 360-day years, and then you have to convert that to the solar year to 365.
Right, yeah. And are you doing 365 and
accuracy
and a third?
That prophecy
no, I use 365, and I use the exact, which is 365.25, you know, 01, whatever the, I forgot what the exact number is, so I use the exact number. Have you been through that math, JB?
Oh, yeah. I went through it in the chapter where you covered it. I was doing the math right alongside while I was going through it. And just when you look at it, the precision and accuracy is just amazing.
Yeah, it's exactly 4 days before
That's
Passover.
That's the prophecy I tend to go to when people are like, prove that the Bible's written by God. Well, I don't say all of it is, but here's proof that this was.
Yeah, it was a March.
Mirror in that.
Yeah. It was a March
30th. You mean you're breaking it down for them, JB? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a Monday. It was a Monday, March 30th, in 33 CE, that he came into Jerusalem. A Monday, March 30th, in 33 CE, and then 4 days later, he became the Passover Lamb. So he came into Jerusalem as the Passover Lamb 4 days before Passover, which was a March 30th in 33 CE, a Monday.
Yeah, that's the day, and he rode in, and there's in the witness writing, they stop and they have a donkey up there. And, get it.
Yep. That is all true. So it is a there are so many affirmations of that time, but the reason
that's important. That's very important. It's you know, that the apophis is very important.
Yeah,
and, you know, and people. Well, it is for affirmation.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah, I also think.
And I'm not
the
talking about affirmation of Yahweh's
words. 2033 Yom Kippurim starts on a Friday at sundown. You know, the millennial Shabbat begins on a Shabbat. You know, there's so many little things. Teruah in 2026, which is the last possible time we can be removed, which I am convinced now after retranslating Isaiah Yashaya 17 that we're going to be harvested, gleaned in the same year the tribulation begins. It's Teruah, and 2026 is a Shabbat.
Wow. Okay.
And so
that's
you know,
perfect
it
too.
So I am personally, I'm really comfortable with that, with the understanding of the timing. But I'm just always cautious in saying, you know, there's issues that the transition from BCE to CE. Without the year zero, and then the change from the Julian to the Gregorian calendar, and all that.
But it could have been done correctly, and I think it was. And the reason that I do is because of things like apophis.
Yes.
You know, I mean, that's what I'm saying. I understand that there's, you know, scholars that debate what the actual date really is and all the rest of that. You know, so they differ by as much as 14 years sometimes, you know.
Yeah, most of everything I've seen is the earliest that you see that has any credibility is 30 CE for 30 CE for Yosha fulfilling the Moed, and the latest date is typically 33 CE. So the scholastic accounting of the time, I've never seen anything earlier than 30 or later than 33. And even then, the people that advocate a time that's other than 33 are doing it for reasons that have really nothing to do with Yahweh's calendar. And it's just got to be consistent with Yahweh's calendar. And once you have 33 set, then 2033 is guaranteed. So it's just a matter of, you know, is it 33? You know, I think it is, but.
Yeah, I think it is because of Apophis. Because of Apophis. It's right there.
Yeah.
I
mean,
I don't think NASA's wrong.
I think that's a nice
hit.
Affirmation, but it's not a. That's low on my list.
Oh, is it low on your list?
Yeah, the Daniel timing is high on my list. The timing of Abraham on Mount Moriah.
You've got the 40 Obel. That's high on my list.
Yeah,
okay.
at 1968 yeah. BCE, that's pretty high on my list. The time that Abraham and Yahweh affirmed the covenant on Mount Moriah is 1968 BCE, exactly 40 Obel to 33 CE. That one's pretty high on my list.
But that's pretty hard to pinpoint down to that date.
The furthest you could be off is 2 or 3 years on that one.
Yeah, but
see, you know, I guess 2 or 3 years. That's significant. But on the foundation of the temple being 1,000 years later, it's 968.
Yeah, that's your mile marker.
Pretty verifiable.
Yeah, it's very verifiable. Yeah, 968 BCE, and there are lots of independent affirmations of 33 CE. I mean, there are lots of them with various historians. I'm as convinced as I think that you can be that timing is right, but the furthest you could be off is 3 years. And if it's 3 years, we have 3 years less than we think we have. I think there is a 0% possibility that it's going to happen after 2033. But it could, you know, 2030, I guess, is...
No, possible. When you've counted the days, and you know this begins on a Shabbat, and Sukkah begins on a Shabbat.
I know. Yeah, I know.
That's all perfect timing.
The days and the fulfillment of Pesach, Matzah B'Kodem, do not take place on the right days of the week in 30 CE. They don't take place, and it's not just the witness writings that say it was Thursday night, the Shabbat being of matzah. It's not just the witness writings that are important in this regard. It's also Yahweh's idea of if he's going to do it, he's going to do it right, and therefore the Shabbat of matzah is going to fall on a natural Shabbat, and it does in 33 CE. It doesn't in 30 CE. It's just like in 2033. You know, according to Yahweh, that Sukkah is going to fall on a Shabbat, and it
on
does.
The seventh day he rested.
Yeah, it does in 2033. And so there's things like that that just scream and say, all right, yeah, I get it. It's pretty hard to
Many of them for it to be a coincidence.
Yeah, it's too many of them. And if you try to move it to a different year, you don't have those things line up. But yeah, that's not to dismiss Apophis. I mean, Apophis is, that's, when you think that 2,000 years ago, Yahusha told Yahochanan, that there's this asteroid, and its asteroid is named Apophis, and it's going to strike the Earth in the midway point of the tribulation, which we now know is Friday, April 13th in 2029, and that's the date that this asteroid is coming back for what they say is a near miss of the largest asteroid to come within the proximity of the Earth during recorded history. And it's, by the way, and scientists named it Apophis.
Yeah, I know. I've got a whole note I throw out there from the...
Yeah, and so, you know, you're dealing with that, and that's really, really tough to dismiss.
Well, it's hard for me to imagine that people dismiss Yahweh's words based on things like that. I mean, there is only one dictated... as in Scripture, peace and what they call a Christian New Testament, or in all the witness writings. This
but,
is Revelation.
JB and Larry, what we're talking about here is something that I have to remind myself that people should be interested in, because I am, my interest in this is hugely diminished. My interest at one time was in this sort of thing because it demonstrates that Yahweh's words are trustworthy.
Yes.
And that God can be known through his words and he can be relied through his words. But my relationship with Yahweh is personally is so far beyond that that I don't look at proof statements anymore. Proof statements in my relationship with Yahweh are meaningless.
No, because, that's true to you. I mean, there's yeah. nothing left to prove to you. You're,
right,
you're
or to you, or to JB. I know.
You're
but,
right.
But I'm glad you keep on bringing this up, because what it does is it tells me, okay, that's where I am, that's where you are, but the purpose of our outreach, I mean, that's where most of the audience is tonight on the Shabbat program. But that's not where the audience is on Shattering Myths.
For Shattering Myths.
And so,
no, that's true. That's all true. I'm not suggesting that.
And there's part of me that says, okay, I don't want to emphasize the proof statements because it looks like I'm trying to prove something when we're already there. But yet, that is really what drew us in. JB, I think it for you was the same thing as it was for me in terms of the thing that really got my attention. The thing that really got my attention was how precisely accurate the Torah's accounting is of creation. And when we were able to do the math of the microwave background radiation, and we learned that the wavelength has been stretched 10 to the 12th, and you do the math of 14 to 15 billion years divided by 10 to the 12th, and you come up with just shy of 6 days. And if that doesn't cause you to get
this, it screams at you.
Oh.
Well, that's when I realized it was all real. I told you that. And
yeah,
I,
so Larry, you would say, oh, no. For all of us, that just goes, oh, my. Oh, my.
Well,
not
all of us. I've shared it with people.
I should pay attention.
Yeah, well, I all of us maybe. I've shared it with people, and they go, "Yeah, but," and I'm going, I booted off my
page
for lowering the IQ for
right. And the reason, by the way, it doesn't total exactly 6 days is too far.
It's still day six.
It not only is it still day six, which is a huge part of it, but a huge part of it is also all we're measuring from the cosmic microwave radiation is that the time after the Big Bang that light energy cooled to the point that it could coalesce into matter. Because prior to matter, we can't measure time. Time is an irrelevant concept.
It didn't exist.
Right. So the 13.8, I think, is what they're using now on the cosmic microwave radiation. It's not from the time of the Big Bang.
There's a whole series of time in between there where physics, as we know it, wouldn't even exist.
And they're saying that prior to the Big Bang, that physics, the laws of physics didn't apply, so they don't even know what to do with it. But that from the Big Bang, you have to go through a period where the energy cooled to the point that energy could coalesce into matter, and because it's only in association with matter that time exists. And so it's just shy of 6 days because there is that period from the Big Bang to matter coalescing that is part of the calculation. But still you come just really shy, just very, very close to 6 days. It's the most amazing calculation that I've ever experienced in my life. That was I think that was the one where you just go, oh, boy. Oh, boy, this is precise. This is to be understood literally.
But then so much of it is, and today we have religious interpretations, and that's too bad because translation is one thing.
Yeah,
obviously poorly misguided translations is another thing.
Yeah, and I don't like to think they're religious interpretation. I think they're religious alchemy. It's religious revisionist. Revisionism.
It probably, it is. I mean, when you look at Yahweh saying, I want to be greeted as an individual, you know, and all, you know, you look at, and you will call me Bale no more. Who calls Yahweh Bale?
Yeah,
they call him Lord. Don't
Lord.
They? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, it's amazing when you consider Dode's statement that Yahweh, you are Tob, you're approachable, you're fun, you're easy to be around, you're a good companion, and he says, I want to be known as an individual. That's God's very humble position. I think there's a reason that God likes people who are humble in terms of willing to recognize that probably better off if I rely on you, is because I don't think he has an ego. I think God is the epitome of humble.
Oh.
Pretty profound the thought there, isn't
makes
it?
Sense.
But yeah, I think he is. I think he's the living epitome of humble, which is
well. We have egos out of weakness. We have egos out of weakness. There's no weakness.
Yeah,
in it.
Absolutely.
Well be, you
but
know?
You know, God's not humble in the sense of dragging himself around and oh woe is me. He's humble in a very powerful way.
No. And by the way, that woe is me thing, that's another religious idea.
Of course.
You,
right.
Earlier, when you were quoting one of the Massals, you mentioned what, you know, the very definition of humble. I've got one that says the very definition of humble, and I quote that Massal, which is just basically, if you're self-reliant, you're dead, and if you rely on me, you're okay.
You're okay.
You know, that's the definition of humble. You know, now you can go take the religious path and rely on crosses and churches and all kind, you know, rabbis.
Are you humble enough that you're going to say, I can't save myself? I'm going to reach up and grasp hold of Yahweh's hand because he's going to lift me up and he's going to take care of me.
Yeah, and I agree with that. I mean, that's the whole point of it. I don't know how to do it. I can't amplify myself into a multidimensional creature any more than I am. I can only die from here. That's all I can
do. That's
fine.
I know this is not a favorite for you, but, you know, trust me, I had a worse father experience than you did by a long shot. And that's why my idea of humble with regard to Yahweh is to be in his kid. Just looking to him as dad and saying,
well, he's clearly the head
I'm,
of the household, isn't he?
Right.
And I'm not saying
you're going to take care of me because I'm your kid. In fact, I look at it and say, you know, I'll go all the way to the point, I'm your responsibility now. Your dad, I'm your responsibility. Me, Yahweh is responsible for me now.
that's a bold
he really
statement.
Is. He's I'm his responsibility. It's, you know, a kid is a dependent. I'm a dependent. And I think that's the kind of humility
he
he's looking
for.
That's
what he wants you to be.
Yeah, I'm a dependent. That's what he wants. I am dependent. He's responsible for me. And my upbringing is going to be at his expense. He's as happy as he could possibly be with that.
Yeah.
But that is a really comfortable position. I don't have to worry. My dad's going to take care of it. I don't have to pay the bill. My dad's paying the bill. I don't have to plan the party. My dad's planning the party. I have to provide transportation. My dad's providing transportation. I'm not responsible for my education. My dad is. I'm not responsible for building the house and maintaining the house. My dad is. Yeah. That's a pretty... it's the most liberating experience that I know. Most empowering, liberating, comfortable, enjoyable position I think you can be in. That is where I find myself just cuddling up and saying, all right.
By just letting go of your own power and relying and trusting on Yahweh, you have a lot of power. That's kind of the way that works.
Yeah, I don't see that being limiting at all. I think that is expanding.
Well, obviously it is.
It's free.
According to Yahweh.
Yeah, it's free. It's expansion in terms of power without the responsibility. I'm Yahweh's responsibility. I'm
power without responsibility is a beautiful concept, too.
Yeah. You know, that's why during the millennial Shabbat, where Yahweh is going to have the Torah put inside of certain, well, he's going to put Torah inside of all of us, but there's individuals that are going to be responsible for administrating the millennial Shabbat, and because he's talking about resettling all of the Yehudim and Yisraelites in their various places, I'm pretty convinced that the administrators of the millennial Shabbat are Yehudim and Yisraelites. Mm-hmm. I don't think we're going to have any responsibility, and I'm really happy with that.
Yeah, I'm okay with this.
Well, yeah. I'm telling you, our name was Hendricks Meyer for a fact. And,
okay,
and
well, you might. Yeah, you might.
You might
have that responsibility. And
I'm not born in the land. I wasn't born in the land.
And if you've got that responsibility, I'll come by and visit with you. But, you know, I want to go out and have some fun.
Yeah, I'm interested.
And, you know, 1,000 years is nothing compared to eternity, so it's not exactly like it's a burden, and you're living with Yahweh, and so Yahweh's right in your midst. The whole earth is back in the conditions of the Garden of Eden. It's not exactly
that
service.
You have no needs.
Yeah, if you're going to have good duty, that's as good of a duty as you can possibly get. But
that's the truth, too.
I'm still not fond of, I'm not fond of responsibility because, I don't. You know, I like the position of not being responsible.
Yeah, you like freedom, huh?
I do. I like freedom.
No manipulation. No
right.
Being manipulated.
Right.
It's a lovely
condition. See, I don't even look at Yahweh as the authority because I'm rebellious against authority.
Well, I don't think Yahweh's trying to present himself as the authority.
No.
But, you know, the people he's interested in knowing are the people that listen to him to begin with. And you know, if you're going to listen to him now, you think you might listen to him when you're face to face with him? I do. You know,
that's the point I wanted to make at the beginning of this, and I do need to run here. But it's my conclusion that in eternity, our entire relationship with Yahweh is going to be based on communication. And so the way we can see him by listening to and reciting and reading his words, I don't think it's going to be significantly different in eternity other than we're going to be much better equipped. We're going to be able to be perceptive in seven dimensions. We're going to be much brighter, much more empowered.
So
all this,
much
but,
better
but,
equipped.
But still, it's still a communication relationship. That's what I think we're going to experience. I still think we're going to think in words. We're going to react to words. We're going to care about words. We're going to communicate using words.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, he spoke the universe into existence. It was words.
If he spoke the universe into existence, then my guess is that words are going to remain rather vital.
Just those words are going to be Hebrew.
The words will be Hebrew. Yeah, absolutely.
That's all right. The Torah will be written inside me.
I'm down for that.
Yeah. We're going to be completely fluent in Hebrew. So that won't be a... and I want to tell you that, you know, Hebrew being an eternal language with the relational stems, the volitional moods, and, you know, perfectly chosen to communicate that which is important, it's going to be a huge upgrade.
Definitely.
Yeah, going to be a huge upgrade.
Especially over English.
Yeah, I'm. Whew. Yeah, I would like some help so that I'm more fluent in it. But man, that's going to be a huge upgrade. And you know, there's so many words that it's just difficult to go from Hebrew to English. Kara, which is so much a part of what we're reading here.
Right.
To read,
it's almost impossible
to invite, to summon, to meet, to welcome, to call out. Wow. I mean, I can say Kara, or I can say all of those words in English. Hebrew is going to be a huge upgrade. You know, I can say covenant, and is there any part of family in the word covenant?
No.
I
mean, we know there is. I know there is.
Yeah, but you can say Bereth, and Bereth is the basis of it.
Right.
And Baeth is family, and Bayreth is family-oriented relationship. So look how much better Hebrew is than English. We can say names in Hebrew, and they scream enlightenment. You know, Yashaya.
Names are important.
Yeah. What does it mean in English? Nothing. What does it mean in Hebrew? Everything.
Well, by the time they go to Isaiah, it means nothing. But Yahweh means salvations from Yahweh, and that's just a fact.
It does what it means in Hebrew, but we have to translate it into English. Wouldn't you just love to embrace the meaning and the original
language?
Oh,
yeah. Oh, yeah. Look, you know, when you do that piece with the six names, the people that decided to follow, you know, help Moshe, you know, with the Torah, you know, and you look at what those names mean in a row.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
See, I look at that as astounding. You know, you don't really find things like that in religious material. You're not going to see something like that in a Quran. You're not going to see something like that in the writings of Buddha or the Zohar. But you are going to see it. You are going to see it in Yahweh's words, because he can take six names and make a sentence out of them that makes perfect sense and is the truth. And,
or you
and
can
you
take
show
the,
that to somebody,
the first,
that should be astounding. You know,
take the first word from each of the first six books that comprise the Torah, and see what it tells you. It's I've done that too, and you just go, whoa. Now I know why he chose. That's why he chose those words to start each one of these books. That's good. Yeah. Yeah, that's really good. Yeah, he's a pretty effective communicator. It's the most amazing thing about the whole thing is this that the calculation, the multivariable equation that was required to speak the universe into existence with just the right amount of energy, it applied in just the precise way to have it all play out like this.
Yeah, see, you're talking about going above and beyond the understanding or even comprehension of anyone ever. You know,
It's pretty astounding, the whole thing. And yet, it's as powerful, as brilliant as the whole thing is, it just really all just falls right back down to, I'm inviting you into my family. Do you want to come?
Of your own volition
and be part of my family. It all gets, all of the fancy calculations and the numbers and the analysis, it just all comes down to that. We have been invited to be part of Yahweh's family. And and that's really where it all comes down to.
Well, your own volition counts so much because, see, so much of religion is about almost force-feeding. You know, really.
Yeah, the only part of that that is still intriguing to me, and I really haven't processed the whole thing yet, but is that I think that Yahweh does play favorites. I think he does. Before we are part of his family, before we have benefited from what he is having to offer, before we really know him, I think he reaches out to us first.
Maybe so. I mean, he did with Moshe, as you pointed out. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Sure.
I don't think he would turn down anybody that, of their own volition, came to know him and embraced the terms and conditions of the covenant. In fact, I'm certain he wouldn't turn down anybody that ever did that. And maybe it's true that a lot of people came to know him that way. I think that there's a lot of people that he did what he did with Abraham and Moshe, where he began the relationship by introducing himself, and in both of their cases he began to work with them long before they knew how to respond to the conditions of the covenant. So I do think God does reach out, and there's people he wants to get to know. Now, since he knows human history in advance, he knows that yet those people are going to choose to respond to him. And so, I feel like I was given an unfair advantage. I'm happy with it. It's God's prerogative. It's not like I cheated. It's not like I'm depriving anybody else's spot in his family. But I do think that God reached out to me and began to introduce himself to me long before I knew what I know now. And I feel very much like, not as important, but I feel very much like what he did with Moshe and Abraham. If God reached out to the guy next door, would that guy have responded? Probably not.
It's been my experience that most people will not.
But I don't know if I would have come to know him if he hadn't first said hello.
Well, you had to have your eyes open in order for that to happen, too.
Yeah, have a willingness. Yeah, mind had to be open, had to be eyes open, mind open, willing. Ultimately, you're willing to go where the words lead.
You ultimately have to be able to be willing to say everything I was ever taught was a lie.
Yeah. I mean, the first time that I engaged in a mission with him, I found myself in the midst of that mission having to reject my religion.
Yeah, I know. Isn't that wild? And,
yeah.
That's when I caught... That's what it was that caught me about what you were doing on the radio, how many ever years ago it was, 10, 11 years ago. You were on a show and you were exposing Islam on the show. And then you started talking about church steeples and Christmas. I said,
yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah,
walked out of organized religion by then, but I was just,
We hadn't been engaged for I wouldn't even say it hadn't been 4 months from the time that I got the tap on the shoulder and say, by the way, I'm God, and I've got a project I'd like for you to engage in. From that time to the time that I had to reject, I didn't have to, that I chose to, based upon where the words were leading. By the time I chose to reject Christianity, I don't even think it was 4 months.
Yeah, I think back at that time you were actually engaging and walking into churches to tell them they were wrong.
Yes, I was. I was.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that's what you said. That's walking in a lion's den there, I guess, to some degree. Right. I doubt if you'd bother to do it today, to be honest.
But I was a nominal Christian, concerned nominal Christian, when I got the tap on the shoulder. And within 3 or 4 months, I had rejected the religion. So it didn't take very long.
Didn't take long?
No.
No,
but
once you understand it, what's the point?
Yes.
I mean,
but what would have, if I didn't get the tap on the shoulder, would I have gone down this path? I don't know. I don't know.
Well, I don't know if I got a tap on the shoulder.
But hey, by the way, should I even care? Because if you look at a relationship, let's say that you see the pretty girl across the room. If you don't go up and say hello, what are the odds are that you're going to have a relationship with her?
Zero.
Zero. Right. Mm-hmm. So is it appropriate for Yahweh to go up and tap somebody on the shoulder and say, hey, I'm interested. I'd like to get to know you.
Yeah. Is it appropriate?
Is that infringing on my free will? Didn't infringe on my free will. I'm looking at it. It's all benefit. Now, does he do that with everybody? Does everybody have that same opportunity? I don't know. Is it even meaningful that everybody would have the same opportunity? Is it even practical? I think it's not practical that everybody would have the same. There is no reason for Yahweh to go tap a young Muslim boy on the shoulder. It'd be a waste of time.
Yeah, when you say tap on the show, I'm not sure what you mean.
I mean, I heard this voice inside of me, and it was God talking to me. And said, I've got a job that I'd like to do. Are you interested in doing it? I mean, that's the kind of, I don't want to, over-dramatize it, but God talked to me and said, I've got a job that I'd like to do. Are you interested
in helping?
That's
huge. I don't think too many people come to Yahweh that way. I don't.
Yeah.
I didn't.
Yeah. Okay, this is an opportunity. Are you interested in doing this? And at the time, I'm not certain that I was much beyond where Moses was in terms of knowing who God was and what he was offering. And what he liked and what he disliked. Probably about the same place that Abraham and Moses were. You know, I came out of a religious community, a religious and political upbringing. I was kind of where Moses and Abraham was, and it didn't stay there very long, however.
Well, thankfully, you know, and there's, you've really shared a lot of words, with Yahweh's words with, now thousands of people, I'm guessing,
Yeah, I was telling Yoel the other day because, if he hadn't enabled the web presence, none of this would have been possible. And I was trying to, because I know he was donating a lot of time and he's got so many other things going in his life, and I just wanted him to have an appreciation for how much good has been accomplished by his devotion to this and willingness to do it. And I do think it is that tens of thousands have left Islam because of Prophet of Doom. Tens of thousands have left Islam. And I would say that there are many thousands that have come to know Yahweh, that have joined us on the same path, that have come to know him collectively through what we're doing together. That's making a pretty big difference in this world.
Oh, I've had so many people tell me, all you do is use Craig Wynn's work. I'm like, I'm showing you accurate translations, and all you can do is not Craig Wynn. Are you an ass?
Yeah, really.
Why do you care?
He doesn't care, by the way. He doesn't care if you knock him, if he took a role in the translation. He didn't care. In fact, the less you know of him, the happier he'd be.
I just had somebody here in Unpopular Truth say, can you give me a Torah reference where Yahweh talks about a pomp? It's not Torah,
Yeah. Give me a reference where Yahweh talks about what?
About Apophis. But I have another one.
I am fairly convinced there's almost nothing in the witness writings that isn't in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. Like, for example, all of the stuff where Yosha is talking about the beast and where the beast is going to come from and how the beast is going to behave and the like. All of it's in Daniel. I mean, he's just reading Daniel. I mean, all he's doing is just reading Daniel. But is there a reference to an asteroid in the prophets? I don't think so. I think that Yosha was actually giving some additional information.